You're now listening to The Brian Callen Show with your host, Brian Callen.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to The Brian Callen Show. Brian is actually auditioning for a large Hollywood feature film. It'll be coming to theaters near you. Whether it has him in it or not is what remains to be seen. So fingers crossed for him. Today we have on Professor Stephen Kotkin, the Berkland Professor in History and International Affairs at Princeton University. And he has just written the first volume of a three-volume series about Stalin. Professor Kotkin, my first question is, would this book have been possible before the opening of the Soviet archives?
Let me just say that I auditioned for that part already, and I didn't get it.
Uh-huh.
So Brian has clear sailing, I hope, given my failure.
You really, like, set him up. It was an assist, you know, an alley-oop, and now it's up for...
Oh, he would have got it anyway.
Okay,
no
well,
question.
That's good.
Yeah, my role, you know, they always joke about, are you in the top 10% of your class? And the answer is I'm much more important than that. I make the top 10% possible.
Well, that's good to know. That's good to know.
Anyway, yeah. So, you know, the Stalin book, I mean, the answer is no. One could not have done this type of comprehensive new look at Russian power in the world and Stalin's power in Russia without the avalanche of new archival material. We've been getting it for a long time, though. It didn't just start last year.
Mm-hmm.
It's been, you know, a 20-year process or so of new materials completely inundating us. And it's complicated because some things they're reclassifying and denying us access to, while other things are just opening up for the first time that had never been opened. But within that complex picture, it's definitely the case that myself and other people working in this field have benefited colossally from the new materials.
And part of that is it's not just that, you know, the archives have been opening up since the fall of the Soviet Union, but also that we've now had 20 years to have scholars process different aspects of it, and so that we can begin to sort of synthesize together a clearer picture.
Yes, I think that's also true. I mean, you know, distance usually helps when you're studying some big historical phenomenon, whether it's the French Revolution, whether it's Hitler's, you know, Nazi regime, whether it's the Stalin regime. And in the fullness of time, Stalin's regime is obviously a failure mm-hmm. because the Soviet Union collapsed. Before the Soviet collapse, you could argue that Stalin had built a nuclear-armed superpower. He had presided over the victory against the Nazi land army, the greatest war ever fought in history, certainly the largest war ever fought in history by far. And so you could argue that even though he was a murderous tyrant, even though millions of people died as a result of his rule and regime, that nonetheless one could be proud of his achievements, certainly in terms of the superpower status of the country. But given that that also was lost, there is a way in which Stalin has been undergoing reevaluation since the collapse of the Soviet Union. But let's remember, you can't take away the war victory.
Mm-hmm.
So whereas Hitler's rule is pretty much irredeemable, it's very hard to say nice things about Hitler and get away with it, rightfully so. About Stalin, you can still say that he was in power when he won the war, even if you don't attribute the victory to him. So forever he will have that, you know, big war victory.
And a large part of what this biography has to do is sort of undo the myths of Stalin that we've been handed by various people. Isn't that right?
Yes. Well, you know, it struck me that it was worthwhile to go back and look and see what the documentation was for the various things we thought we knew, and not to take anything for granted. Maybe it would pan out. Maybe I would see that what we thought we knew was correct, but maybe it would turn out that the documentation was flimsy or non-existent. One of the things I thought about was the idea that Stalin was beaten as a child, that he had a particularly traumatic childhood, and this is sometimes used as an explanation for pathologies of his personality and for the kind of sociopathic behavior we get from him. Well, it turns out there's very little documentation about how he was beaten as a child. There's really only one significant source by an emigre, somebody who escaped from the Soviet Union and knew Stalin in childhood and wrote about how his father beat him. It's very dramatic, it's a very sensational account, and it might be true. but we don't have corroborating documentation for the most part. We have a couple of indications that maybe his mother beat him. We have some indications that maybe his mother beat the father. In any case, whether he was beaten or not, I was beaten as a child, and I have yet to murder, you know, 10 million people.
But give you time, right?
There is still time, but nonetheless, I see it as unlikely.
Well, that's good to hear. Thank you. Thank you for your mercy. So that's one narrative that doesn't really pan out. There's also, I mean, a lot of these narratives were also driven by Trotsky, right? Stalin's rival for power.
Yes. So what we have with Stalin is we have the regime lying like crazy to make Stalin out to be, you know, a god. And then we have Stalin's opponents lying like crazy to make Stalin out to be a non-entity. And so it's kind of difficult but necessary to navigate the various different either hagiographic, you know, propaganda accounts of Stalin or the really, I don't know how to put it, but sort of understandable from a psychological and political point of view, but not accurate denigrations of Stalin. You know, Trotsky lost the battle with Stalin, but he survived because Stalin exiled him abroad. It took Stalin essentially from 1929 to 1940, right, to kill Trotsky. There was an assassination in Mexico, infamously, in 1940. But during those 11 years, Trotsky wrote a great deal, and he helped shape, everlastingly, he helped shape the image we have of Stalin, both at the time Trotsky was writing and subsequently. So it's kind of necessary to go back and look at that. Some things that Trotsky pointed out about Stalin certainly hold water. You know, he knew Stalin personally, and he had a sense of Stalin's personality. But a lot of the stuff is just explicable only as the loser in a political battle, not verifiable information.
And so the beginning of the book, I mean, there's a large section at the beginning of the book where you really have to lay the groundwork and really establish the world in which Stalin grew up in, even almost before you get into the life of Stalin himself. Why was that so important?
Well, you know, Stalin's early years. Now, let's remember, he's born in December 1878. And the revolution, the October Revolution, sometimes known as the Bolshevik coup, happens, right, in 1917. So that's, you can do the math, that's 39 years old when the revolution happens. Stalin becomes General Secretary of the Communist Party in 1922, April 1922. So once again, then he's 44 years old. But let's take the 39 years old. Not that much significance of great significance happens in his life in the first 39 years. So people have had two strategies on that. One, they do a really quickie, you know, 0 to 39, and they put in the fact that he was beaten by his father, that he went to the seminary, that he was an underground revolutionary, got arrested, exiled to Siberia, and boom, 8 to 10 pages later, the revolution is happening already.
Mm-hmm.
The other tactic people have tried is to invent a fantastic, unbelievable first 39 years. He was a Lothario and had all sorts of lovers here, there, and everywhere. He was a mafia kingpin in the prisons and ran gangs all over the place and plotted and helped carry out assassinations. And you get this romantic Lothario orientalist, fantastic figure.
Mm-hmm.
And so that obviously is a great story, and many people would appreciate a story like that. It's just not well documented that he had that type of early life. So what was I to do? Was I to take the skip-it approach or the kind of inventive, let's call it, approach? And I decided neither. Instead, I said, let's sketch in the world in which Stalin was born. Let's talk about who controlled the Russian state before him, what type of things they tried, how they succeeded or failed, and what he inherited. What was the world that he shaped, that shaped him before he began to shape it? So, crazily enough, a biography of Stalin, it begins with Bismarck and Bismarck's mm-hmm. unification of Germany. Now, before the 1870s, there were 30-something German states, and Bismarck made a single German state, and all of a sudden there was a new German power, a new great power on the continent in Europe. The same decade, the 1870s, there was the Meiji Restoration in Japan and the sort of consolidation of the Japanese nation and the beginning of industrialization, economic takeoff, and conquest in East Asia. So you had a new power in East Asia with the Meiji Restoration. You had a new power in Europe, Bismarck's unification of Germany. That's the 1870s. And it just so happens that Stalin is born that same decade. He's born 1878, as we said, periphery of the Russian Empire, washerwoman, mother, cobbler for a father, and it's just absolutely unimaginable that somebody like him is eventually going to take over as ruler. So you sketch the world into which he's born, and then, of course, you also have to explain that that world was destroyed, mostly in World War I. Otherwise, a guy like Stalin could have never gotten anywhere near power.
And specifically, I mean, you know, with the consolidation of Germany in the West, and then the, you know, Meiji Restoration in the East, you suddenly have that Russia finds itself for really the first time in a very long time wedged between two great powers.
Yeah, so it's a rupture in world history for everybody, for the British Empire, for the United States, for all major countries. The unification of Germany and the Meiji Restoration of Japan are a rupture, right? But for Russia in particular, because it's on either flank of the country. Mm-hmm. So, you know, geography doesn't determine the fate of countries, but it's a really big deal. Let's think about this for a second. You know, if you're going to pick a geography, you're going to get a choice. You're going to say, well, you know, you're going to come into the world, where would you like to be? And my choice would be to have the Atlantic Ocean on one side, the Pacific Ocean on the other side, Mexico below me, and Canada above me. That's a kind of friendly geography. Mm-hmm. I think I would be happy in a place like that if I were a great power. But, you know, Russia has not only German power on one side now and Japanese power on the other side, but it still has the British Empire below it, and it has that huge band of Islamic countries or Islamic empires below it too, part of which are controlled by the British and part of which aren't. So it's in a very complex geography, and managing Russian power in the world, figuring out, you know, what would be Russia's proper place and defending Russia's interests in that geography turn out to be really difficult problems that the Tsarist regime fails at. It loses a war to Japan in 1905. It loses a war to Germany in 1918, right? Stalin inherits these circumstances, and then he discovers how difficult it is. You know, he's a dictator at home, but he's not a dictator abroad. And he's got to try to manage this Russian power in the world in this difficult geography. We see a smaller scale version of this today with Putin. How to manage Russian power in the world, how to deal with the geography, how to deal with the neighbors. Putin is not a figure on the scale of Stalin, but some of the things that Stalin was dealing with, we see Putin dealing with as well.
So on the eve of the revolution, right, when 1917 rolls around, what is Stalin's role in the Communist Party?
So the Communist Party, it's very important to understand that Tsarist Russia, which is, you know, controlled by an autocracy, by an autocrat, for a long time politics is illegal, meaning they don't have a parliament until 1905, 1906, when the regime almost is overthrown because of the lost war with Japan and mass uprisings in the cities and in the countryside. So politics for a long time is illegal, and even when the Tsarist regime grants, grudgingly, a parliament known as the Duma, it's trying every which way to take that back, to walk back the creation of a parliament and maybe to get rid of it. And so leftist politics are illegal. Still, underground revolutionary movement is what you get, because the regime is repressive, and to fight the repressive regime, you have to use underground tactics like terrorism, for example. So Stalin is a member of this underground. He is for many years. He joins the revolutionary underground while he's still in the seminary and leaves the seminary without getting his degree, without sitting his final exams, in part because he's in the revolutionary movement already. Now, the revolutionary movement, however, is pretty much a failure. One of the things I show in the book is that there's not a march from, you know, Lenin and his various different writings, through organizing strikes and peasant uprisings, through the 1917 revolution. It turns out that the Tsarist regime was repressive successfully, And the revolutionary movement was infiltrated by the secret police. Most of the revolutionaries were arrested. Almost all of them were in prison or in exile. A lot of them were in exile in Europe, like Lenin, for example, was in Zurich, Switzerland. Stalin was in exile in Siberia. The whole time of World War I, from 1914 to 1917, Stalin was in a very remote area of Siberia, so he fought the war on the Mosquito Front, the Boredom and Mosquito Front. But then the Tsar falls in February 1917. There's a conspiracy of his generals because the war effort is going badly and they want to remove the Tsar, even though they're monarchists, to try to stabilize. Anyway, it goes on, and Stalin comes back from Siberian exile to the capital, St. Petersburg, with a suitcase that has a few things in it, sort of the size of a briefcase and a typewriter. That's his whole life, the tiny little briefcase, suitcase, and the typewriter. But then he takes part in the revolutionary agitation in the capital. In other words, the successful suppression of the revolutionary movement that the political police under Tsarism had effected over many years is now busted wide open because of the war and the overthrow of the Tsar. And now you have guys like Stalin agitating. But for the longest time, really from the period of the early 1900s through 1917, he had only one legal job. He was briefly a weatherman in Tiflis, today known as Tbilisi, the capital of Georgia. He would record the weather at the observatory there. That's sort of the only legal paid job he had. He was a pundit for outlawed illegal revolutionary newspapers, most of which were closed down when the police found them. And so between that weatherman job for a little while, the revolutionary punditry that was mostly illegal, and then the prison and exile and boredom and mosquitoes and et cetera, that was his life. And so he was not considered a success, certainly by the age of 39, when the revolution happened.
So it was unimaginable at the time of Stalin's birth that he would have ever risen to power, and age 39, it was still unimaginable.
Yes. However, there was one thing that was really important that we need to add, which is the fact that he had met this guy Lenin. And Lenin was the founder, the leader of a certain faction of leftists. The leftists divided and subdivided and divided again because they fought over the issues. And Lenin, however, saw in Stalin something. He saw that the guy could troubleshoot, implement difficult assignments, do some things that were maybe unpalatable to others, but if you gave Stalin the assignment, he would carry it out, no matter how difficult or unpalatable. In addition, Stalin was ethnic Georgian. And so in a multinational empire, the revolutionary movement, from Lenin's point of view, could also use people who represented, who looked like the multinational empire. Most of Stalin's fellow Georgian leftists were Lenin's opponents. They were what were known as Mensheviks, against Lenin and his Bolsheviks. A fight about how the revolution should be fought, organized, how the party should be organized. And Stalin, however, unusually, was not only an ethnic Georgian, but he was an ally of Lenin, or he was loyal to Lenin. So this loyalty proximity to Lenin, Lenin's promotion of Stalin, Stalin being a protege of the Bolshevik leader, was what enabled him to get very close to the seat of power, because it was the Bolsheviks, of course, who seized power in October 1917. And so right from October, Stalin's one of the four people of the inner Bolshevik regime, along with Lenin, the leader, Trotsky, and somebody named Yakov Sverdlov, who dies in 1919. So Stalin's one of the four.
So his great wisdom, or his great fortune, whichever it was to get close to Lenin. And then, you know, as Lenin rose, so Stalin rose with him.
Correct. And that was partly Lenin's doing, and it was partly Stalin's doing.
Right.
And so Stalin needs to get credit for perceiving this opportunity. And for the most part, Stalin was very close to Lenin on the issues. In other words, Stalin would go to school on Lenin's teaching, Lenin's urgings, at the various different knockdown, drag-out fights over policy. it was very rare that Stalin expressed any differences with Lenin. So he stayed very close to him. He emulated him, and he went to school with Lenin. In other words, Lenin was a flexible tactician, but he was a man of hard principles from a Bolshevik point of view, and Stalin began to be a person like that too.
And one of the parts of Stalin's personality that is really argued about is it seems like Trotsky really depicted him as this very sort of uncharismatic figure. And then, you know, obviously the Soviet media really worked in the opposite direction. But he seems to have had this ability to imagine himself, right? He had a series of nicknames, a series of like Koba, and then obviously the name Stalin itself. Do you think that was a large part of why he was able to succeed, that he had a real flair for the dramatic?
Yes. Now, people can get into really high positions sometimes through luck, right? They know the right person, or they're in the right place at the right time. It can happen that luck is pretty decisive sometimes in history. But it's very rare that luck is going to be enough to keep you there. It may help you get there, but to keep you there for 5, 10, 20, 30 years, luck is usually not a sufficient explanation. So Stalin clearly had some tremendous natural talents. He was very skilled at certain things. He had a kind of ability to size people up, to cut to the core of their person, to see their vulnerabilities, and to maybe blackmail them or manipulate them through their vulnerabilities. At the same time, he could be very, very charming. And he won a lot of people over with his charm. And so his abilities are maybe not the same abilities, let's say, if you're looking for someone to lead the global struggle against poverty on behalf of charity. In other words, I would pick Mother Teresa, for example, over Stalin, if that were going to be my goal. But if you're looking for someone to build up a dictatorship, defend Lenin's legacy, and, you know, carry this Russian power in the world problem on his back, then Stalin clearly stood out among contemporaries in terms of talent. He was very sly, very, very shrewd, cunning. He was ruthless, but he was also a very hard worker. He spent a tremendous amount of time doing the grunt work, the drudge work of organizing this party machine, of finding personnel and promoting personnel, of giving them pep talks about how to do their job, right? So he showed these leadership skills. In addition to the dramatic roles that you were alluding to, the chameleon, the fact that he could be a certain way one day and another way the next day, a certain way to some people, a different way to other people, he also sort of put in the time, as we say. He did the hard work, the heavy lifting. And that was appreciated by those around him. And then you get a little bit of the self-fulfilling prophecy. In other words, people started to see that he was rising, and they began to attach themselves to him in the power struggle. In other words, in choosing between Trotsky, Zinoviev, another one, Kamenev, Stalin, people began to see that Stalin looked like the winner in that power struggle. And so then he began to acquire a whole lot of people who came over to his side voluntarily.
And I want to quote from, you know, the last section of your book asks basically if Stalin had died, what would a world without Stalin be like? And there's this really excellent quote that you have here that you begin by quoting the historian E.H. Carr, who said, "More than almost any other great man in history, Stalin illustrates the thesis that circumstances make the man, not the man the circumstances." And you respond, "Utterly, eternally wrong. Stalin made history, rearranging the entire socioeconomic landscape of one-sixth of the earth, right through mass rebellion, mass starvation, cannibalism, the destruction of the country's livestock, and unprecedented political destabilization. Stalin did not flinch."
Yeah, I think that's right. And I have to say, you know, I wrote a book. It's 739 pages of text, although a friend of mine said it reads like it's only 620. That is to say, the pages just fly by.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, it's all about the structures, the big impersonal forces in history that could produce something like Stalin,
mm-hmm.
right? The Russian geography that we were alluding to before, right? The particular institutions of the Bolshevik regime, the secret police in the Tsarist era and how something like that carries over after the revolution. Right? So there are all these structures that could somehow give you this type of personal dictatorship and this type of guy who might be the leader of that. But when all was said and done, right, did his personality nonetheless play a role or not? So that's the question. After you figure out all the impersonal structural forces, which are crucially important, what's the role of the individual and the individual as an agent in these big historical processes? So here you have a revolutionary regime that's committed to socialism. They read Marx, the Communist Manifesto, which says, you know, capitalism is great, it produces a lot of wealth, but then it begins to slow down, create crises, depressions, and it's unjust, it's alienating people, and so we're going to build a world that transcends capitalism, we're going to build socialism and eventually communism. And the way we're going to do that is we're going to get rid of, we're going to eliminate the market, private property, and the hiring of labor. So this is the idea of the regime. And they're a monopoly. They don't allow any other political parties. In fact, the party itself is very, very hierarchical, let alone alternative parties. There are almost no alternatives within the party for discussion as time goes on. But they lived through World War I, the revolution, a civil war, horrific famine, and the country is flat on its back. The railroads are destroyed, industries destroyed, right? People are starving, and they decide they need to recuperate. So they grudgingly, in 1921, 4 years after their coup, they grudgingly allow legalization of the market within limits, right? They allow peasants to control their land and to sell the products of their work, the harvest, right, on markets. There's not very much market and private property in industry, even in the 1920s. Most of industry is state-owned. But nonetheless, there's a tremendous amount of private trade, and especially in agriculture, the market is operative. What this does, however, from a communist point of view, is create this really big contradiction between a regime dedicated to the elimination of capitalism in the market, private property, and a country that has recuperated precisely because the market and private property have been legalized. So this contradiction gets worse and worse, and they don't know what to do. They fight in the regime over it. No communist of significance in the 1920s at the top of the regime is calling for accepting the market and private property permanently. They're all dedicated to transcending the market, getting to socialism, and getting to communism. But some of these people are afraid that if they try to force the end of capitalism, that they'll just end up with, you know, mass violence, chaos, ruin, and maybe another famine. And Stalin says to them, you know, either you're communists or not. Right? Either we go for this or not. And they say, you know, we're dedicated, we're committed to doing this, just not right now. Let's continue to benefit from the class conciliation policy, from the market, and let's continue to recuperate, let's not destabilize the situation. So Stalin unilaterally decides he's going to do this, even though the others don't want him to do it. He makes a trip to Siberia in January 1928, which I describe in the book. He announces that he's going to do this, end of capitalism, build socialism in the countryside immediately. And everybody, of course, is shocked, because how are you going to do this? Right? Collective farms in 1928 account for 1% of the arable land, 1%. And the average collective farm is about 15 to 16 households. So you have 25 to 30 million households, and very few of them have voluntarily joined collectives. So you can't get them to voluntarily do it. The only way you can do it is coercion. And like I say, Stalin's comrades, also communists, are worried about what that coercion is going to cause. So what we see is, not only does he decide that it's time and he's going to force this collectivization, but he actually does managed to do it. It's just as big a mystery, maybe even a bigger mystery, how he did it, not just why he did it.
Well, and as you said at the end, you know, his willingness to persist with it, even after, you know, starvation, cannibalism, all of these things, he didn't flinch. He really was the man of steel through and through.
You know, I mean, that's the thing. We've often pictured Stalin as a man of supreme calculation. Like I said, very cunning, very shrewd, increasing his power. He'll do anything to increase his own power. But here we have a Stalin, as I present him in my book, who's a man of conviction. He's a man of deeply held conviction. Now, those convictions I regard as pernicious, you know, erroneous. I think he was wrong. But nonetheless, I do believe that he was a true believer. Only a true believer would have risked everything he risked and would have continued through thick and thin to follow this path, because it was, just like his opponent said, if he tries to force collectivization, it's going to be ruinous. That's what they predicted, and that's exactly what happened, but he kept going. And one of the ways to explain not only why he did it, but why he kept going, was because he thought it was deeply right and deeply necessary for the revolution, to defend the revolution, to build socialism.
And I think that's what's so powerful about your book, as opposed to other biographies on the subject, is the fact that rather than depicting Stalin as a monster, a Machiavellian, a sociopath, you really portray him, and I guess this is what the evidence shows in the archives, that he really was a true believer. And the fact is that we live in a world of true believers, from, you know, whether it's religious belief, political belief, whatever it is. And we don't think that we could be monsters, but we could be true believers who stick to erroneous convictions and end up causing more harm than good.
You know, when you humanize evil, it can actually be more horrifying sometimes.
Yeah.
Depicting monsters is pretty easy. You know, cardboard cutout. I mean, that's why we have Hollywood, right? It's very easy to figure out in a movie very quickly who the good guys are and who the bad guys are, even if they don't wear white hats and black hats, right? And this helps us quickly, right, orient ourselves in the narrative. Moreover, the bad guys were bad. I mean, Stalin was a bad guy. He was a monster. He was a murderous tyrant. But to say that may inhibit our ability to understand not only how he got to be Stalin, but why he did what he did and how he could do what he did. And so you kind of humanize the evil, as it were, to understand it. It does not validate what Stalin did. It does not revise our understanding that he was maybe a nice guy. But it does give us a more complex picture of what evil really looks like and how it operates.
Okay? And where it comes from, most importantly.
Yes. And so, you know, there's evil, and there are convictions, and there are people who are tyrants, etc. But there's a big story here, which is about the options of Russian power in the world. If you were going to run this big country, the biggest country in the world, one-sixth of the Earth, approximately, you know, one-sixth of the Earth's landmass, right? What are your options? And that's why when you look through the Tsarist regime, the first 100-and-something pages of the book, right, you look through what the prime ministers under the czars did, you look what the finance ministers did, the people in charge of the police and foreign policy, you start to see how it wasn't very easy to manage Russian power in the world. They had their own convictions as well and how that played out, right? Then you get to Stalin and you have a combination of all the problems that he's inherited, the new problems caused by the Bolshevik coup, and the narrowing of options because of the dedication to anti-capitalism. You know, I talk a lot about fascism in the book. Stalin got fascism wrong. He had a kind of class analysis of fascism. He was shrewd on many things, but he was blinkered on just as many things, including on fascism. I go through and I talk about how the fascists also had a dictatorial regime, but they didn't go after the rich peasants. They didn't go after the merchant class and traders. They didn't go after the big capitalists. Instead, they did bargains with these people because these people created the wealth. So you can have a dictatorship and not be against the market, not be against private property. So it's that extra ingredient It's that communist manifesto from Marx and Engels, right? It's the desire to transcend capitalism, to do what they thought was building a more just world, right? It's combined with the Russian power problem, how to manage Russian power in the world. It's that combination in which supreme evil becomes possible.
Well, and it's also, growing up in Tsarist Russia, it's very obvious to Stalin the evils of a hierarchical, aristocratic, capitalist system. And so it's natural that he wants to rush as far to the other side rather than realizing that the answer may lie somewhere in the middle.
Yeah, he's responding to real problems. You know, Lenin is not somebody who invents the idea that people are being oppressed. Lenin's solution is to oppress people even more. But people are definitely being oppressed in Tsarist Russia. And so, yes, Stalin and those who are on his side are responding to really big injustices. They think they're going to fix those injustices. They don't. They create greater injustices. But they're willing to do certain things precisely because of the scale of the evil that exists in their day that they're fighting against. You're right. And this deepens their convictions, both that it's necessary and that any means would be appropriate to build socialism. This is one of the things about Leninism that sometimes people can't get, or it fools them, right? There's a set of precepts. You know, Lenin has a lot of writings about instructing people how to understand and organize, how to understand the world and organize the party and the fight for social justice and for Russian power. One of the things he says, though, is essentially flexible tactics. You know, any means are appropriate to pursue the ends, including violating your own ideology. And so that leads people to dismiss the ideology. They keep saying, well, look, you know, Lenin is backtracking. Lenin is going against what he himself wrote. But tactical flexibility, in other words, a zig and a zag to get to the eventual goal, is something that Lenin taught Stalin and that Stalin perfected. And it was a weakness that Trotsky had. Trotsky also had deep convictions, the same convictions that Stalin had. But Trotsky lacked that kind of Leninist extreme tactical flexibility. Now, tactical flexibility, we don't want to go too far here. It's a euphemism in some ways for shooting and killing your opponents, or jailing, you know, exiling and deporting your opponents. That's what tactical flexibility often amounted to in practice. But you cannot understand communism, you cannot understand the Soviet Union, you cannot understand Stalin unless you talk about ideas.
And in certain areas, he had tactical flexibility, but clearly in certain areas, he didn't. On the issue of forced collectivization, he was not willing to budge.
Well, he had been, you're exactly right, except that up till 1928, he had been on the side of retaining the concession to the market that Lenin had introduced in 1921. Now, no communists like this. They were all, at the beginning, against the market and private property. In 1921, 4 years after the October coup that brought them to power. But Stalin, as the man in charge, Lenin gets ill, and then Lenin dies in January 1924. So Stalin, certainly before 1924 even, but after 1924, Stalin is in charge of continuing to hold the line on this Leninist concession, this tactical flexibility vis-a-vis the village. You know, allow the peasants to control their harvest and to sell it on markets. However, and he's fighting Trotsky, he's fighting Zinoviev, he's fighting a lot of other people high up in the regime who want to overturn this concession, the Leninist 1921 policy called the New Economic Policy. They want to overturn it, and Stalin holds the line, and in fact, he deepens it at various points. However, when Stalin feels that it's absolutely necessary, finally, to go for it, to go for the jugular, right? He does go all the way. That's the period of, you know, beginning in January 1928, when he goes on this trip to Siberia. So he has shown the tactical flexibility himself. He hates the market, too. The market is anathema to him. Capitalism is evil. But he's flexible enough to allow it to do its work on behalf of the regime until he sees it more as a threat rather than a helping to the regime. And boom, he suddenly breaks through, overturns it, and doesn't look back.
I want to go back to what you were saying earlier about Stalin's blindness to the dangers of the fascists. You have this great quote here. Stalin's inability to understand fascism was sorely evident. He followed Lenin, who had insisted that the non-Bolshevik left, Mensheviks, SRs, other moderates, were the most dangerous of all counter-revolutionaries because they hid behind the mask of socialism. That seems incredibly human to me to feel like the neighbors at home, I mean, they're so obvious to you, you can see the problems with them, and therefore to be blinded to the dangers of threats from abroad.
You're right. You know, there's a tragedy on the left, whether one is a leftist or not, whether one is sympathetic to the left or not, there's a tragedy on the left, which is the division, right, between the social democrats and the communists. Both of them come out of the same womb, as it were, but then they divide and they're at daggers drawn, and they never can overcome this divide. And this divide means that they're sort of the same family, however. And so Stalin perceives the Social Democrats as his main competition for the allegiance of the European working class. He wants the German working class to be communist, but the German Social Democrats are much more popular than the German communists among the German working class. This drives Stalin up the wall. He just cannot abide social democrats because he's a Bolshevik, and Bolsheviks don't believe in half measures. They don't believe in bourgeois parliaments. They don't believe in evolution, right? They believe in eradication of parliaments, eradication of markets, right? Transcending capitalism. So he sees these half measure people as the enemy, because they're claiming the mantle of socialism, but to him, they're phonies, because they're not going all the way like a real communist like himself and Lenin. However, what he doesn't see is that the fascists are able to appeal to the working class also, and that fascism is not some cover for finance capital. It's not some cover for big, colossal financial interests. It's instead a very broad-based national movement that has appeal to the very same constituencies that the communists are trying to appeal to. And so Stalin, by going after the social democrats, further divides the left, weakens the left as a counterpoint to the radical right. And the fascists are able, in part because of their own skill, in part because of many problems that are happening in Europe, eventually the Great Depression, but this is even before that, the fascists are able to take advantage of the leftist divisions, and Stalin, in many ways, undermines the opposition to fascism, so he's partially responsible, not fully responsible, and Hitler also proved to be more talented than people understood him to be. But Stalin's misdiagnosis of fascism as a lesser threat than the social democrats, he calls the social democrats social fascists. In other words, substituting the fascist term for the Democrat term. And he unfortunately misreads the rise of fascism, contributes to it, eventually makes a slight correction. But in the end, never, ever do the communists and social democrats close this split this on the left. As a result of which, the left is weakened, the right is strengthened, in part because the right sees a double threat, both social democrats and communists, and the traditional right and the radical right actually come together, and that's how Hitler comes to power, because of the threat of the left, whereas the left doesn't come together in order to counteract the right, the rise of fascism. So this is a major error that Stalin makes in analysis and policy, which has global repercussions, and which in many ways outlives him.
And again, just reinforcing the idea that Stalin was human in every sense.
Yes, you know, you can be really smart and do some really stupid things. And he did that. In other words, we have to get away from the characterization of black, white, either or. You know, either he's power hungry or he's a true believer. You can lust for power and have deep convictions. You know, either he is brilliant and shrewd, or he's an idiot ideologue blinkered. Well, actually, he's all of this at the same time. But capturing that is not easy, and it's one of the things I try to do in the book.
Well, and I think you do it very, very well. I mean, I think that's what's so interesting is that obviously Stalin is such a figure who's been mythologized for so long, and to have to undo those various competing mythologies and reveal the humanity of someone who at the same time did so many things that were so horrific is a great challenge. And I think you do it very well. And I think we're all looking forward to seeing volumes 2 and 3.
Well, thank you.
I did have one question in terms of that. I mean, I know this is kind of a sneak peek, but obviously one of the events that I think we often wonder as amateur historians about a lot is the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact. And, you know, based in the light of the fact that Stalin had so misunderestimated the threat of fascism, you know, what was he thinking at the time?
Yeah, so Volume 1, what I just published, came out this month, covers the years, you know, 1870s to 1928, the decision to collectivize agriculture. The actual collectivization kind of takes place off stage. Sometimes films are better if the murder doesn't happen on screen, but if maybe you see blood splatter on the window or you just hear the gunshot but don't see the gun. And I wanted to make the collectivization decision, the decision to enslave the peasantry, I wanted to make that the core of Volume 1, the culmination of Volume 1, in terms of the decision to do that. I wanted to set the collectivization, Stalin's enslavement of the peasantry, in the full sweep of Russian history. Hmm. Now, when you get to Volume 2, which covers the years 1929 to 1941, it culminates in Hitler's invasion of the Soviet Union on June 22, 1941. When you get to Volume 2, that time period, usually the core aspects are Stalin's terror when he murders his own elites, which happens primarily in 1937-38, and then it's the foreign policy stuff, the pact with Hitler in 1939, and the lead-up to the war, the intelligence Stalin had. Did he see the war coming? Did he prepare for the war or not? You know, how was he at managing foreign policy? Why did he murder his own elites? And did he misinterpret Hitler, get it wrong, and screw up so big that the Soviet Union was almost defeated by the Nazi invasion in June 1941. So it'll probably be about 2 years before we get to Volume 2. I'm putting the finishing touches to the draft right now. And not to give anything away, because we don't want to ruin it for those readers who, my mother is no longer alive, but I'm nonetheless counting on there being some readers of this volume. Without giving too much away, all I can say is there are just as many surprises in Volume 2 about Stalin as there are in Volume 1.
So what you're saying is no spoilers.
Yes, I think you put it very eloquently.
Well, then I guess that we'll just have to wait for 2 years. Let me ask you briefly about just the experience of writing, you know, a tome of this size as part of a three-part installment. I mean, you know, what was your process in doing that? I mean, in terms of your previous books, they've, you know, obviously dealt with, I mean, Magnetic Mountain, Stalinism as a Civilization. You've dealt with a lot of the period, but not necessarily the man himself.
Yes. And so, you know, I wrote a book which was Stalinism Seen from the Street. I picked a town, a Soviet steel town, built very close to something that was actually called Magnetic Mountain, and the town was called Magnitogorsk. But it's the street level. You know, it's this one city of about 200,000 people built from scratch. And how do you build socialism from the ground up? How do you create a non-market municipal economy? How do you organize a monopoly regime? And in writing that, picking one town, you could do a total history. You could do the politics, and you could do the culture, and you could talk about the school system, and you could encompass the entire life of the people. And I got to know a great number of those 200,000 people, obviously no longer with us, who lived in the town during the 1930s when Stalinism was built. But, of course, now this is the whole regime. And, in fact, a biography of Stalin begins after a certain time period to become a history of the world. Because not only was he in charge of this large country, one-sixth of the earth, but also he was the leader of the global communist movement, and Soviet foreign policy touched on all areas of the world. So, you know, so imagine, for example, Washington, New York, and Hollywood all rolled into one, because the politics, the economy, and the culture, right, are all part of the regime. There's no private property. There's no private sector. It's all controlled by the regime. Imagine Hollywood, Washington, New York rolled into one, and then imagine one person being in charge of that. So the scale of trying to render this view from Stalin's office across the regime and across the world is just so vast. It's very daunting. One of the things I discovered, though, is that if you work through not just the Communist Party archives, but the foreign policy archives, the military archival material, and the secret police, the former KGB, you work through all of this, you can begin to recreate almost whole days of Stalin's life. Mm. You can start to put stuff together. You can see how in a single day he might have line-edited a novel or pre-screened a film that had to go through a final edit, his approval, before being shown on the screens across the country. You can see how he read through the military intelligence and wrote instructions on it. You can see how he convened meetings in his office to decide whether to build this kind of tank or that kind of tank. Right? You can get a sense of what his day looked like and the repercussions of his power. You know, this is a book about power. And one of the interesting things about power is not only how it's accumulated, not only how it's exercised, but what the consequences of the exercise of power are. So that a guy in an office receiving people or reading documents, writing on documents, thinking through strategy, can have repercussions that are unbelievably, whole nations can get deported. Entire countries can get invaded or not invaded on the basis of this guy's power in this office. So as I began to write this daunting thing, as I began to conceptualize and execute on the research and the writing, it was the focus on Stalin's power that actually helped me manage, even though the scale is so big.
Well, I mean, I, you know, we've recently been subjected to three Hobbit movies, and that felt like an unnecessary trilogy. I think this was definitely a necessary trilogy.
Well, let's hope you're right. I mean, in the end, you know, Stalin is a very big subject. It's hard to imagine subjects any bigger. But you have to keep the reader engaged, and you have to continually show the surprises in history. One of the things we make a mistake on, right, is we take the end point, we go back and look, and we show everything that led to that end point. And the other stuff, we kind of squeeze out of the story. You know, it's kind of like machining down, planing down the rough edges. But great history, real history, history as it's actually lived, is full of surprises. It's full of dead ends. That is to say, paths that looked like they might pan out but didn't pan out.
Mm.
And so the length of the book, in part, has to do with the full history, the paths that weren't taken, the complexities, the randomness, the accident, the unintended consequences, the perverse consequences, the stuff that actually happened, rather than telling a teleological, you know, driven narrative to an end point where we kind of know the end point already. How about if we don't know the end point yet? What did the history look like? And that's the complexity that sometimes takes a few more pages than the usual.
Well, and that's also how we actually learn from the history, because if we simply sit, you know, 70 years later or 100 years later with the authority of knowing how things turned out, then it's a foregone conclusion and we can say, oh, in those situations, I would never have done that.
Exactly.
Well, Professor Kotkin, the John Berkland Professor in History and International Affairs, thank you so much for Volume 1 of Stalin, Paradoxes of Power, 1878 to 1928. Looking forward to finding out about Molotov-Ribbentrop in Volume 2, and then in Volume 3, presumably hearing about the Great Patriotic War and the beginning of the Cold War.
Yes. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you so much. And I know that Brian would love to interview as well at some point, so he can ask you a whole different set of questions.
Anyway, you know, wish him luck. I hope he gets the part.
Well, you know,
he's got a great show.
He does have a great show.
And he's deserving of this part. And, you know, sometimes we need a break. He deserves it, but he also, like Stalin, he could use a little bit of luck, I'm sure.
Well, I'm sure that, you know, he's very happy to hear that he's mentioned in the same breath as Stalin.
Some have greatness thrust upon them.
That's true. That's true. And I'm certain that he would be perfectly happy if he was from now on referred to as the Man of Steel.
It's been taken. He'll probably have to think of another one, but we'll work on that.
I did want to ask you as well about Koba. Koba is a character from a novel, right? He was a sort of Robin Hood figure.
An Avenger, the little guy who ends up, you know, winning out in the end. And so that was very popular in Georgian society. But also Stalin's surrogate father, the guy who paid for his education, was named Koba. Yakubi Ignatashvili, a Georgian, and whose nickname was Koba, because Yakubi, which we know as Yakov in Russian, Yakubi in Georgian sometimes was shortened to Koba. So we're not sure if it came out of the novel, the famous Georgian novel, or it came from the surrogate father, or a combination of both. But it was a great nickname for a while. And Stalin loved it, and people called him Koba right through to his death in some cases, those who knew him from childhood. But it was a very Georgian name, Koba, whereas Stalin was a very Russian name, a very Russifying name. So Koba had the charisma of a great revolutionary nickname, but Stalin was really an unbeatable revolutionary nickname in the Russian context.
Well, there you go. Thank you so much, Professor, and have a lovely day.
All right, my pleasure. Bye-bye.
Bye. This has been the Brian Callen Show without Brian Callen, because the kid's a huge star. Check briancallen.com to find out where the kid is doing stand-up. Somewhere in North America, near you, maybe. And if it is, I encourage you to go.
You've been listening to The Brian Callen Show with Brian Callen. Be sure to like him on Facebook. Just search for Brian Callen Comedy. And follow him on Twitter. Just search for @BrianCallen. You can also find him online by visiting his website. Just go to briancallen.com. Until next time, bye-bye.